let's say Dave and Ollie say hello.
Hi, welcome everybody. I do apologise, I'll be dipping in and out a little bit just to have a little cough here and there. I've only got a little tickly cough going on, but I do hope to retain my voice throughout this session and answer any questions where they may come, but welcome to joining us today.
Yeah, and hello Ollie.
Hi Phil, hi everyone. That's awfully convenient, Dave, that your voice seems to be going at just about this time on a Friday.
I would agree. It was fine this morning, wasn't it? It just started to go downhill a bit.
Yeah. So what have you seen? What have you been up to this week? What have you seen? I've seen some really good stuff in the news, actually. What have you seen and what you've been doing, both of you?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of bits of things in the news. Did you catch a thing yesterday? I think it was in the news yesterday regarding the Duchess of Sussex and a High Court case against the Mail on Sunday.
I saw it in the BBC, but didn't read anything about it.
It was there's various different claims. I think it's the second part coming up where it's got some kind of data protection matters in there. But it was in essence they went in her favour. And it was held for a claim for misuse of private information, and it was held by the court that it was the personal handwritten letters between Meghan and her father were inherently private and personal matters, and there's a reasonable expectation that the contents of the letter would remain private. So it kind of went in her favour on the elements of privacy, at least. But I'm led to believe somewhere that I read that there's a couple of DP issues that may come up, but they've not been dealt with at this point, and they may be dealt with at a later stage.
All right. Right, interesting stuff. Anything else? Or Ollie, what have you been up to? What have you seen that's been taking your eye?
I've been on with plenty, as ever. But in terms of bits and pieces that have caught my eye, I was doing the rounds on Enforcement Tracker this morning, as I normally do in preparation for this, just to see if there's anything that particularly stands out. And, well, actually, there have been a few bits that jumped out at me, which is the AEPD, our Spanish friends, have been particularly busy, as they usually are, to be fair. But flavour of the month for them seems to have been enforcement against individuals for misuse of CCTV. So in the last couple of months, they seem to have handed down three separate fines to individuals acting as controllers for use of domestic CCTV, but which captures a public space. So in two of those instances, the individual controllers were fined, I think, €2,000 and €5,000 respectively for a lack of a lawful basis for recording a public space, even though they were a domestic controller, which is interesting.
Right.
But then the one which I found really quite interesting is that in the third instance, an individual controller was fined just over €1,000 for putting up dummy cameras which weren't actually in operation.
What?
They were just there to basically act as a preventative measure to dissuade anyone from, you know, committing any wrongdoings. But the AEPD found that was sufficiently privacy intrusive, that it was affecting the behaviour of individuals that come into the quote-unquote field of view. Yeah, that they fined him, initially to €2,000 and then reduced to €1,200. I thought that was fascinating.
Mad.
Especially as we've seen a lot of activity in our housing clients in particular of late, with individual tenants putting up CCTV and potentially entering into controllership on their own.
Yeah.
So really flavour of the month.
Interesting.
Two
really interesting things I saw. There was a case, Travel Council v Trail Finders, where an employee left. That might go the wrong way around, left Finders, for instance, and took the company database with them. I think it was two employees left and took the company database with them, which we know is theft of data. We know it is an offence. But in this particular case, the court found that the recipient organisation, Travel Counsellors Limited, as an actual organisation, owed a duty of confidence to the others, Trail Finders, and found against them. So not only was the employee actually handed down an 8-month custodial sentence plus 100 hours of community service plus ordered to pay cost of £1,000 and effectively a fine of £25,000, but also the director of the company was also given exactly the same sentence for turning a blind eye to this theft of data. So that's really interesting, because that's kind of the responsibility of directors that's drawn out the Data Protection Act, not the GDPR, really coming into effect. And the ICO prosecuted again under the Computer Misuse Act rather than the Data Protection Act. So that was fascinating. We talked about this, haven't we? Section 199, is it, of the Data Protection Act, about directors being culpable and finable and punishable. It says punishable, doesn't it?
So I think it's 197 or something, I think it is. But I'd caught that as well. Yeah, I'd caught that as well. I found it really an interesting read, though.
It's 198 specifically, chaps, because I was looking it up this morning for something.
We'll settle in the middle.
The other thing that I saw again in the news last couple of days was we talk about this quite a lot. There were the ambulance chasers. The next PPI is data protection breaches, and class actions. And we've had clients who've suffered from this, haven't we, Dave? Mm-hmm. Anyway, in Weaver v. EWHC case, the judge has ruled that the cost of advertising for claimants isn't recoverable under a class action. So what the basic suggestion is, class actions, because these guys were saying that it had cost them £1 million to advertise for claimants, and it's taken them a long time to build their case, and the courts found that wasn't recoverable, which is interesting, because that might actually slow down all this activity that we have been predicting on class actions in this kind of data protection space. Did you see that one?
I certainly saw that one. I found it interesting because I think the claims management firm in the article said that they had 200,000 victims seeking compensation for the British Airways. They didn't name British Airways, but they said the airline and the massive fine, so it was British Airways. And so they've got 200,000 victims. They've already incurred costs of $443,000 and intend to incur a further $557,000 on future advertising. And they're going to lump all that into the potter's cost.
Gin and all the rest of it.
So it's I'm actually quite happy that the courts have decided it that way, in that sense, because it's that was part of marketing and promoting their business, not necessarily direct cost associated with a group litigation order. Hopefully it might calm the market down a bit, because we do see quite a lot of it. I saw an advert on Facebook for that kind of thing, group litigation for a serious breach or data breaches. Have you had your breaches affected, that kind of thing? And I thought I'd click on it just to see what happens. And because of the engine that Facebook is, every time you go on it now, you just keep repeatedly seeing adverts by different providers trying to tout for your business, which is just horrendous. To the point that I'll probably just switch off Facebook completely in that sense. Yeah. But you do just see more and more of it.
I found that I found this last week, actually. I didn't have time to mention it. I found it quite an interesting tool on the ICO's website, which enables you to sort of click through a few screens to generate contracts and international transfer agreements. So we'll have to probably share the link for that. That's really quite useful. So click, and then it outputs a PDF contract. Quite good. Standard contractual clauses.
No, absolutely. I was just going to say the other thing that I'd seen in the news before we move on, I don't know if you caught it, although to be fair, it's towards the end of January. There was an article about whether your face will replace your bank card, and it's used in China, it's been introduced in the US and Denmark and Nigeria, of all places, where when you get to the till, basically it looks at your face and then deducts the money out of your account.
All right.
So it's
have you ever watched The Young Offenders? Have you ever watched The Young Offenders, that TV series or the film? No, it doesn't matter. You have to get your Billy Murphy mask out then. Anybody who has seen it will look. Everybody else will look. Right. Anything else in the news?
I just found that quite interesting. It's a BBC News article, and I just found it a bit interesting because your mobile phone's already you can use your mobile phone for accessing banks and login details where they want facial recognition. So is the supermarkets doing it? Is that just an extension of the phone's capabilities, or is it actually a step too far into privacy?
I'm surprised, really, in a way, because I've read some sort of mixed opinions on the use of biometrics. Everyone said, half one school of thought saying biometrics is the most secure way because your thumbprint's your thumbprint. And another school of thought saying, yeah, but once you get, really, what happens is you get a digital impression of your thumbprint, you know, pushed through software. And once you've lost it, you can't create a new password. You can't create a new thumbprint. You know, it's gone. It's out in the public domain. So if it does get compromised, you know, you're stuck really with biometrics. So my view is, I think that they are, you know, might be unique to each individual, but you know, it really shouldn't be used for ID verification in that way. There was something on the news I saw. There's 100 or so people in, I think it was Malaysia, who've been born with no fingerprints, and they can't get government ID cards because you need a fingerprint to get them.
Interesting. It's like with the article that I just mentioned, it highlights in China that they use facial recognition, or at the Sun Yat-sen University, they use facial recognition to get food from a vending machine.
All right. Did I ever tell you about the vending? They saw the best vending machine ever in Italy when I was skiing a few years ago. It had half a dozen fresh eggs in it. Imagine that. You're putting your €3 and the thing turns around and all your eggs drop down like 5 feet into the bottom of this vending machine.
Were you visiting during Pancake Day?
No. No, I wasn't. No. Anyway, listen, to rabbit on. Ollie, have you got anything else? What have you been working on this horizon?
Sorry, what was that, Phil? I just lost you.
Yeah, what else have you been doing this week, case-wise or news-wise? Nothing?
Yeah, well, I mentioned at the top, possibly not everyone was in, but that my week's sort of been consumed with going into a client's business's external to do a breach investigation. I can't say too much about it, as I'm sure you appreciate, but it's basically just conducting root cause analysis on that breach, which is very interesting, and we'll see the outcomes of that. I mean, the thing being that the breach in and of itself was pretty classic of the housing sector, if I'm being honest, and not particularly bad, but we found that there was a specific trigger which meant that it was sufficiently risky, or there was a sufficient likelihood of risk to mean that we have to report to the ICO, or the business does anyway. So it should be interesting, but yeah, that's primarily occupied my week, to be completely honest.
All right, okay, right. Should we talk about accountability then? That's really what we want to be going through today, isn't it, really? So just put the privacy notes up again for any late joins. We're recording this session, that's the information that you need to know about it. If you want to object, then let us know afterwards, or we'll see if there's any of your personal data on the recording, we'll take it off. I think I've caught up here. I don't know if anybody's seen the accountability framework. That's kind of where it is. So, you know, the notion of accountability, Dave Ollie, it's not new, is it? It's been around for donkey's years in data protection world. In fact, it was in the 1980 OECD guidelines, and quite clearly referenced in the 98 Data Protection Act as well. So, you know, it's not something that's new. It's never really been focused on before, has it? But I have to say, the accountability framework, which we're going to dig over today, is really, I think, quite onerous in some areas. You know, it's quite focused, isn't it?
Yeah, I would agree. I think you seem to speak to some people, and they kind of think the accountability principle under the GDPR is something new. And I think the ones you highlight, the fact that, as you mentioned, it's in the OECD, it's in Convention 108, and previous laws preceding that. And it's certainly been something that's been discussed for many years. It's nearly as old as the hills, isn't it, if you want to kind of use that kind of phrase. So it's certainly been there. It's maybe just not been explicitly brought through with the 1998 Act. But it's certainly there, and you don't have to just use the word accountability to be accountable. And we'll certainly look at those elements moving forward through this next half hour as we discuss accountability.
Yeah. It's funny because it was in the DPA quite explicitly, Section 4. It says that it shall be the duty of a data controller to comply with data protection principles in relation to all personnel which is a data controller. What's different, I think, in the GDPR is one thing is saying you're accountable. The second thing is saying you're accountable, you have to demonstrate compliance. I think that's the new thing, isn't it? You know, you've got to demonstrate compliance. And what we wanted to talk about today, or what I wanted to talk about today, but we can change that if everyone wants to talk about something different, is this accountability framework that the ICO has put out there. You know, does it go further than the GDPR? You know, does it go put, does the ICO expect more than the law requires? Now, that's what we want to try and dig into today, isn't it? And have a look at, well, what are they saying? How is that accountability framework structured? What does it say? And is it fair and reasonable? And would that count against you in the event of an investigation by the ICO by not having, you know, anything or suitable up to the standard in the accountability framework? Because it's not a statutory code, is it? It's just a framework. In fact, the way they've published it, if you have a look at it on this link, it's got no cover page. It's just a 98 page. It's quite good, isn't it? I like it. It's quite well structured and it's quite useful to work with.
And I think it's well structured. I think it's easy to work with. And I like the bits where they kind of go, in order to meet our expectations, you need to think about these bits. So I think it certainly helps to give some kind of direction and flavour to accountability and what kind of some of the measures that you need. But I think you hit on two quite fundamental points, really. You've got accountability and what is accountability, but then it's actually demonstrating compliance. So if you're trying to demonstrate compliance, obviously that's one way to meet accountability, I guess. But is that accountability in itself?
Yes, it's interesting. We've talked about this before, haven't we? In most European languages, accountability is a word that doesn't actually have any direct comparator. The closest is responsibility. And you know, is the GDPR drafted in such a way as to mean accountability or responsibility? But this is an academic legal discussion. We've talked about this before, haven't we?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we've also spoken in the past about how proportionality is embedded in European laws, opposed to in a way that which it isn't necessarily in our laws. So it is quite an interesting point. I mean, as you said, there in practice, in the European languages that I know, which is French, there isn't necessarily the straight comparison, as you say. You have a concept of responsibility, but there is something greater in accountability. It's perhaps the demonstrability. I mean, maybe that ties in inherently to the concept, but no, certainly you're right on that front.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for the useful thing to be doing is to go start to have a look at this framework. And I've been through it again this morning and highlighted just a few points that I thought, well, I think these are the ones we should be talking about because they're either possibly a surprise, and like, oh crikey, I didn't expect the ICO would want us to be doing that, or something a little bit controversial. But before we get into that, I mean, it does say that its purpose is the six things highlighted. One is to enable, if you wanted to create a comprehensive privacy management program, then the framework it says is useful for that purpose. It's also useful to checking your existing practices against the ICO's expectations. And again, I think that's really important because the ICO is laying down, you know, we're expecting to do this. You know, data protection law has been around for decades, and you know, this accountability was in the previous law, maybe not quite drawn out as explicitly. So this isn't new. And that's really the essence of what they're saying, I think, on that point. It also says that, you know, it's useful if you want to consider whether you could improve existing practice. So that's a similar point. And we're doing this, the ICO is expecting that. Is there a gap? You know, should we be changing our work practices? It says the framework is useful to understand ways to demonstrate compliance. So again, I think that's coming back to, you know, demonstrability, and the ICO is ultimately the regulator. You know, whatever they are expecting is something we should sit up and take note of. Another final kind of increase in senior management engagement and privacy awareness. Again, the framework is useful for doing that because a lot of this is about, that leads us into this first one, the leadership and oversight section on the accountability framework. What's useful, guys, is because it's got these 10 categories. Then within each category, it's got subsections broken down. So, for instance, on the records management, the breach response and monitoring, it's got these other bullet points, and then for these bullet points it's saying, like for instance on page 94, that in terms of external audit, it's saying your organization arranges what we expect, your organization arranges an external audit or other compliance checking procedure. So they're saying out here that they're expecting external audit provisions to be commonplace and part of your regime. The performance and compliance, it says you have KPIs. We talked about KPIs quite a lot on these sessions, haven't we? But these are the KPIs that the ICO is setting out as a minimum in the accountability framework. So what's good about it, I think, and you know, chime in, Ollie and Davis, and anybody else, is the way it's structured is, you know, kind of a statement about each of these topical areas, you know, breach response monitoring, for instance, and then a set of bullets about what they expect, and then some tests, you know, how will you know if you comply type thing, which poses questions, aren't they?
They are, and I think it, I don't know if you ever can you cast your mind back. There was the working Article 29 Working Party opinion in 2010 on accountability, and that kind of gave accountability as a two-stage test of looking at you need to implement something. So, for example, you're implementing appropriate measures, appropriate and effective measures, but then you've got to demonstrate as well. So you've got two elements of implement and then demonstrate. So the demonstrating part is a bit that you're getting at the moment with, well, how do you demonstrate what you've implemented and that you're adhering to them?
Yeah, I'm going to just kind of, if you haven't seen it, I'll just show the screen here. So yeah, it's got these different 10 points in here somewhere, anyway, but they're in there. And then it's like, so for point one, it's on leadership and oversight. So why is it important, useful? And then at a glance, you know, what we expect from you. And then some further reading resources. And then it goes into like the first point in these bulleted organizational structure. And then it's saying, again, this is what we kind of an introductory narrative. And then ways to meet our expectations. Again, really useful stuff. And then can you answer the following question? So it's a 98-page document, but and it's only one page, isn't it, per each of these each of these sections, if you like, or subsections. And I like the structure of it. I mean, I was a bit critical of it before, because I didn't think it actually gave you much. But reading it again, a bit more down the track, I think it's actually pretty good, this document.
I like it. Like I say, it's it certainly helps to kind of put a flavour around the things of what they may be looking for and ways to meet their expectations. The only concern I would have possibly would be whether organisations would look at the ways to meet their expectations and go, right, that's all I need to do. And kind of read it as a kind of, if you've got this in place, you're compliant, as opposed to these are kind of flavours of the stuff that that would meet our expectations to demonstrate your accountability.
Yeah. So one of the things in here, again, kind of the first one to look at is the expectation that there is some form of group, that you know, a steering group, data protection compliance management group or something internally, that's got, you know, regular meetings and it's appropriately, you've got appropriate terms of reference, etc. Minutes are taken. So again, I think this is quite a high level of expectation in terms of information governance. And some organizations are probably geared up to do this, but many smaller organizations, you know, are they? Have they got the right resources? Have they got the right knowledge? You know, I think this is quite high expectation. What do you think?
I would tend to agree with you, Phil. It's a question I get a lot from possibly some of my smaller clients. On a large scale, I think it's obviously possible. If you're a big corporate or even just a large organization generally, you're going to have the people and the resources to be able to put in these types of groups and these types of mechanisms. But on a smaller scale, it's just not practicable, I don't think. And I would tend to agree with you in that regard, that therefore it sort of sets quite a high bar. I've recommended on a number of occasions that we don't even look to implement them with some of my clients because it's not feasible. You know, the resources aren't there, the people aren't there. And at the end of the day, I don't want to implement mechanisms which we're not going to be able to keep up with fundamentally. I don't know if that's something that you've come across much, Dave.
Yeah, for sure. When you're looking at doing due diligence on some suppliers, if you've only got a small supplier that's maybe only got a team of five people working with them, like you said, they won't have the governance structures, they won't have the mechanisms in place to do this effectively, either time or resources. In that sense, whereas larger organisations that I've worked at have a proper governance framework in place, so you would see similar ways to meet expectations. and in essence taking data protection off it and put health and safety on it. So there'll be a health and safety oversight group, there'll be a health and safety governance structure, and appropriate reporting and checking that health and safety within an organisation is maintained. So when you've got a sizable organisation with the resources to implement it, then it certainly helps, but it's you've got certainly a lot more smaller organisations that may struggle to implement something similar to that due to the size and nature of the organisation itself.
Yeah, there's a few. Am I crackling? I'm crackling loads, am I? I don't know if that's my microphone banging on my jumper or my poor bandwidth. There's quite a bit in there about training, isn't there, as well? There's a section on training and awareness. And it said you need an all-staff training program, an induction, refresher training, specialised roles. Again, this is nothing that hasn't been said, you know, by us for the last 5 years or so. You know, got to monitor it, you got to do awareness raising separate from training. Again, that's quite a good section, isn't it? It gives you some pretty good, guidance from what they would expect. And nothing there really is surprising, is it?
No, I wouldn't have said anything in there was surprising and a little tongue-in-cheek, but I think the ICO must have been sat on some of our sessions that's then filtered through to the accountability framework. Because all this kind of stuff is common sense stuff, like you mentioned with the training. You've got to have it cyclical. You've got to have training for new starters. You've got to have role-based considerations in there. And that, to me, just seems all the natural kind of stuff that you would have.
Yeah, I'm diving about a bit here, just trying to pick out some of the interesting. This was interesting, I thought, on individual rights. So again, I don't know if you had a chance to see this. So this is the, you know, the number three, four of the categories, individual rights. And the resources is interesting because they're kind of expecting people to have a whole team of employees ready to deploy to handle rights. Again, there's nothing new there, nothing surprising there, and nothing onerous there really, you know, but interesting that they're expecting that to be there. You've got sufficient resources to deal with requests, and if a staff member is absent, you train other staff to pick up the key tasks. So, but not a lot of our clients have got that, have they? They haven't got, you know, teams of people pre-trained, you know, regular refresher training, and if there is an upsurge in requests, you know, we struggle, don't we?
It is. The upsurge is a particular one that I'm interested in from a rights point, because how many people's, how many organisations' processes around rights are scalable should you suddenly find an influx of DSARs? You might be able to manage one a month or a couple in a month, but if you had a serious breach, for example, or there was an orchestrated campaign against the organisation and you suddenly had, say, even just as many as 15 coming in 1 month, your measures have got to be scalable in order to manage that.
Yeah.
It's definitely interesting.
Yes, definitely.
Well, I think I was just going to raise a quick point here, is that there is an awareness of this, I would argue, amongst controllers. And something that we've seen in the last couple of weeks, possibly the last couple of months, particularly in the housing sector, is that in social housing, there's set to be the introduction of a new power for tenants, which creates a freedom of information style power where they can access information that's not personal data, which previously didn't exist. Housing associations, or at least those that aren't, ALMOs, aren't subject to the Freedom of Information Act. And there's been, I mean, for want of a better word, absolute panic across the sector, at least the people that I've spoken to, about this power, how they prepare for it, how they train their teams appropriately, how they adjust their processes to be able to handle all of this. It's a really good point, I think, generally, having the resources available to be able to cope with these types of requests.
Yeah, good point. I was going to jump forward to the bits about transparency, so just bear with me while I won't scroll through it all in front of everybody, because it's going to be not good to watch. But the transparency obligations were quite good, because again, there's an expectation that your staff and can explain privacy information. Is that something that you think in general we're geared up to do? Or is that usually the privacy information is the preserve of, you know, the privacy officer?
Yeah, I saw that, and to be honest, I thought that was possibly verging on being disproportionate if you're talking about all of your staff being able to rattle off your privacy policy in full. I mean, possibly I'm over expanding that, but generally I thought that was really quite onerous. I think, you know, relevant individuals within the business, possibly, maybe if we're talking about process owners, perhaps, or as you say, the privacy specialist in the business. But, you know, for all frontline staff, I just thought that was quite a high bar to meet, really.
I think one interesting question to kind of pose, just kind of on the back of that, really, is when we're looking at accountability and being accountable, who are you actually accountable to as an organisation when you're looking at the accountability framework?
That's a really great question. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, you're accountable to the data subjects, aren't you, to a large extent, and accountable to, in fact, there's a whole network of accountability, accountable if you're a processor to controllers, accountable under a joint controllership arrangement, accountable to the regulator, accountable effectively to shareholders or stakeholders. I think it's quite a broad net, isn't it, really?
I think it is. I mean, ultimately, you've got accountability to the regulator, but I think it goes further than that with the bodies that you mentioned. Whether you should be accountable to the data subjects, because privacy and rights and everything's a cornerstone of data protection, and making sure that your processing activities are respectful of fundamental rights and freedoms. So you're certainly accountable to data subjects, but you should be accountable to internal stakeholders, external stakeholders, data subjects. And such like. So I think when you're looking at accountability, we just need to be mindful of who we're accountable to. So when you're looking at privacy information, and the question that you posed to Ollie there, well, who are we being accountable to from a privacy point? Well, that's clearly going to include the data subjects, isn't it? So are we infringing the data subjects' rights by a lower understanding of privacy across the organisation, where people can't reiterate or have a decent understanding to talk about privacy with a data subject if they spoke to them about it?
Yeah, it's a good point, Dave. I mean, do we feel accountable to data subjects, or do we feel primary accountability towards the regulator? I don't know. You know, good question there. I was interested in this one here, you know, and again, this is something we bang on about, and Dilly could probably back me up here in terms of when we're auditing. We say, well, you know, have you got a log of historical privacy information and changes, and effectively who's seen what, you know, which bits of the privacy information framework you've got has that particular customer seen, you know, because the expectation here is that you've got that level of detail. But in practice, again, it's usually quite hard to do that, particularly historically. You know, going forward, it's probably easier to get a system in place, but historically, it's quite hard, isn't it?
It's interesting, because I think to a degree it ties in, and you were saying who's actually seen what, to consent management, which I believe is also one of the things which they discuss in here, and periodically reviewing your consents, proactively reviewing your consents, in fact, to make
they do,
sure
yeah,
they're all up
they
to
do.
Scratch and yeah, making sure they're refreshed where appropriate. I think it all ties in. In that sense, I think the framework does work quite well in that. In it doesn't leave too many loose ends, as far as I'm aware. It ties in quite nicely between the different requirements. So, yeah, I mean, it might be onerous, that concept of, you know, who's seen what. But also, there's a real use in that if you can actually implement it in practice.
Yeah, with all this stuff, if you can implement it in practice, it gives you a high degree of control, but it's a big overhead in maintaining it all, but you know what we've found, haven't we?
Yeah.
This
data map.
Phil, just sorry, I am around. It's just I was wondering when to step in. So I just like you, I absolutely adore the accountability tracker. I think it's some additional information for us to be able to actually measure something against. Now, when I undertake audits, I do take fractions of the ICO's tracker to audit against. So more so around the leaderships and where the roles and responsibilities are communicated. So I do take fractions, because as you can see, the tracker is huge. But I also do advise my clients, look, we will be starting to, now that you're business as usual, we're no longer in a project position, we're now business as usual, what we're going to start doing is having a look at the accountability tracker, but the sections that apply to us that we feel we could improve on, or an area we haven't reviewed in over a year or 2 years. So we just merely use it as some form of a guidance. And I can see some of the stuff, Phil, I've seen some of these questions or what their ICO's expectations. And I think that's not really proportionate nor practical in the large scale of things.
Let's look at this one then. So data mapping, okay? So the expectation is that you've got information audits, you've got data mapping exercises that you carry out, you know, periodically, and you've got a data map, and you clearly understand who's responsible for what on that data map. Do you find that in practice when you go out and do audits? I mean, comprehensive or just focused on high-risk processing activities? What do you find when you're going out?
I find that when the whole GDPR kicked off, everybody had some form of a register, whether that's a processing register, whether that's an information, everyone had good old registers. I've come across clients or come across situations where it's not been touched in over 2 years and it's not been reviewed. And I, at the moment, when I attend my client steering groups, you know, always have my voice heard, as you know, Phil. One thing I do advise them is it's been a long time. We now need to review your information assets because we're working more at home now. You guys have some new fancy tools, some new processes, new systems, and I know that will change your information asset, your data mapping. So we then go back.
Carry on, Dilly.
Yep, that's fine. We then go back and revisit those registers. So what I'm doing at the moment, I'd say the more sophisticated one, clients of mine have got their registers or business as usual. What we're doing at the moment is going through their data mapping, seeing what they're collecting, whether that information is further disclosed, because we recently found out due to the pandemic, the team who accesses CCTV cannot access it. Therefore, new access has actually been granted to another department, the ASB team. So that means that there's other individuals who access those data. So it's meant that we've actually had to just skim through all of those registers, because I know though they're going to be out of date. And, you know, usually they fall out of date within a matter of a few months, especially now with the pandemic.
But you get challenged on this kind of stuff, Dilly. If you're kind of saying, well, the accountability framework says, for instance, you've got to have data maps, do you find customers turn and say, well, no, we don't. You know, where does it say that in the GDPR? You know, does this overstep the mark, really, this framework? I mean, it's all sensible stuff.
I think they might be a bit too scared to challenge me. They're usually like, they're like telling me to do something, it must be right. But I usually do tell them, look, there's going to be some changes. Most of the time, there's not much work involved because some of your assets will remain the same. But when I say to them, okay, well, you've got this brand new Maya portal, it's now doing loads of other bits of information. Now you're getting information from all sorts of locations. Right, now we need to go back and revisit what you've stated in this document. So the register or your mapping document or whatever you want to call it, where it's capturing that has to be accurate and that has to be readily available. So, you know, I don't think they have much of a choice, because at the end of the day, if I turn around to somebody, and I always do this, I say, tell me where is your weakest area in your department. If I said to you, what was the most critical or riskiest operation or your assets or data's going moving around, not many people are that confident to say, oh, so and so. That's why I always go back to this data mapping. I always go back to that register.
Yeah. What do you find, Ollie, when you, I mean, you've started quite a few clients off recently, haven't you, on their compliance journey? The obvious place to start is, right, we need to compile records of posting activities. We need to know what you've got. We need to know how information flows through your organisation, as it says here. Do people push back or do they embrace that?
Generally speaking, what I've been seeing is that the initial, so there are two things. If I sort of say, we're going to undertake a data mapping exercise, we're going to revitalize ROPAs, or even if it's not ROPAs, even if it's, you know, supplier registers or an information asset register or any type of record keeping. If I say, right, we've got a big task we're going to go through, we're going to do it, we'll log all the collection points, we'll conduct a mapping exercise, we'll, you know, select a piece of data and we'll follow it through the system. Generally, even though there might be a few groans, generally the buy-in is okay. The issue is less with that. The issue is then with actually keeping up with those obligations, updating registers as you go, making sure that they're all up to speed. And I was recently having a conversation with a client where they said, oh, well, it's great, well, we can go through and do the register of suppliers, but we're going to have to implement a process to check this, you know, periodically, because the individuals responsible for procurement are just not going to keep this up to date themselves. And that is quite a battle and it can be quite frustrating. So to me, that's where the issue lies, generally speaking, more so than the initial push to get those completed, if you like.
Right. I mean, maintaining them is tricky as well, isn't it? I mean, basically we're expecting a routine for ensuring that, you know, there's a methodology for updating data maps and for, you know, deleting data flows that get changed. Another code, PCIDSS expects to have an accurate network map, and you'd be able to tell me, Dilip, whether 27001 does. But, you know, there's other codes and guidelines where that is expected, factor requirement.
Just going back to your data mapping, Phil, when you got this obligation, as you kind of demonstrated, to maintain them, accountability should then, by extension, extend demonstrating that you've maintained it. And that might be quite difficult to achieve where your ROPAs, for example, are Excel based. And the fact that you got, how would you demonstrate that each line's been reviewed, or have you reviewed process around your ROPA? Whereas if you had kind of an electronic version, or some system where you capture the metadata in the background, that might be easier to demonstrate.
Dave, just to add on to
when I was doing some auditing.
Just to add on around, how do you demonstrate? Because Excel document is a commonly used mechanism to capture that sort of information. It's just the most common one. I think all of my clients, bar one, has an Excel document. And it is difficult, like you said, on version control, or how do you demonstrate it? So what I do is I add an extra column at the very end of that register so that every year... So I just put the date. So right now I'm going through it with a couple of my clients where we'd put February 2021, and then we go through each of those information assets. So let's say there's 10 of them. We go through each of them and say, right, is it up to date? Is the privacy information still valid? Do we need to undertake any assessments? One of them, we've just done a DPIA on the vehicle tracking. So we've updated it. So that column is updated as of today's or this month. Then it's hidden from view so that nobody can see that. Then what we do is whenever we do go back and review it, that's the only way really I see it as tracking and demonstrating you do review the register.
I mean, we're running out of time, but I'll just hop pause on this one. So process of due diligence checks. Again, it's suggesting the other parts of this suggest a flexible process. You do appropriate due diligence. But this was interesting that, you know, security checks might include site visits, system testing, audit requests. I've told you I've been on site visits before. I'm so famous when I'm in a kebab shop in Soho with a data centre brother. But again, how many people do that? I mean, it's hard with COVID now, but, you know, getting out there and, you know, going and inspect a processor's premises and practices and actually what you're looking for anyway. I think it's really good to have it in here as, you know, an aspirational, this is what you should be doing. But, you know, this is, you know, ways to meet the expectations of the ICO. You know, you imagine a breach, you know, what did you do in terms of due diligence? Well, we had a chat with them. Well, did you go on site? You know, did you test it? Did you audit them? No, right, okay, well, that doesn't meet our expectations. Is that how they would approach it?
I would have thought so. I mean, the flip side of that being that I was reading up on something the other day, and you'll have to forgive me because I can't remember where I read this, but I remember it sticking in my mind, was that I'd seen the suggestion that in some circumstances it might be appropriate as due diligence, perhaps as part of it or in its entirety, to get references from other customers of the processor, so other controllers, to the effect that they're compliant. And I remember reading that and thinking, that doesn't give you anything, does it? I mean, how much can you really rely on that? I'd have thought that was a really, really low standard of due diligence if you were looking to rely on it.
I would agree there, Ollie. I wonder if Marriott said the same thing with Starwood Hotels, and Starwood responded with, yeah, it's all fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I do have clients that do site visits. So I know that you mentioned there, how feasible was it be to do some physical audits? I do have clients that do them for physical sites, so where their data centers are, or they do, it's more formalized. So they will do more of audit around the storage in. So I've had one recently that audited. It wasn't so much as a formal audit. It was just to check how it is that their data, the paper records, are being archived at their facility. Of course, you don't know where the facility and things are, especially with data centers. But I do have clients that do spot checks, physical checks on them, and record them. They do that almost annually, actually. So there are loads of different ways. It's not simple.
Yeah, often it's contracted out. All the inspections I've done generally have been as a consultant. You know, we sent down to a data center to inspect it, sent over to a processor, you know, mailing company to inspect it, write a report and report back. So, but I mean, what the ICO is saying, and I think this code was launched in September last year, wasn't it? So it's early days really, but this is the direction of travel. You know, at some point in the future, the ICO is going to say, you know, you need to engage a third party or go yourself and check all these processes. I mean, taking a risk-based approach, so some you wouldn't have to necessarily go and inspect, but those that are doing a substantial amount of processing, or you know, with particularly sensitive data, or you know, particularly sensitive data subjects, you know, the expectation is going to be you've got a mechanism for continually keeping them under review. Just because we're short of time now, final ones I wanted to have a look at. I sent this to you beforehand. I wasn't sure if you were coming on, Dilik. Have you got anything you wanted to highlight out of this in particular, or talk about the practicalities? It was this external audit that I wanted to highlight, sort of, which is interesting. Again, there's an expectation that you get external audits undertaken. And again, might not be an expectation today, but certainly, you know, the direction of travel. So you can imagine a situation where there's an annual external audit of the data protection compliance management system undertaken by, you know, people like us or auditors or other consultancy firms. But this is where it's going. And this kind of auto certification, again, it's all going to come together at some point, I think fairly quickly. You know, where the ICO is going to be saying the accountability framework wants you to do this, therefore, you know, go and do it.
I would agree. I would also think, would you expect some of this to be, again, you mentioned being risk-based, whether it's risk-based. If you're a very small processor, a two-man, three-man band, for example, only taking name and address details for small maintenance repairs at properties, would you expect the ICO to still expect them to be externally assessed and assured? Or do you think the ICO are kind of trying to hit the middle ground here, with a greater expectation on organisations where there's a greater level of processing, all different ranges and sizes of volumes of personal data, whereas the smaller organisations are going to have a little bit more kind of leeway with what you think?
Yeah, my experience, I haven't any experience of the ICO in accountability, but my experience of them in general is that they would be looking for a process. So if your process is, we look at the big ones, we don't look at the small ones, then they would probably take a view on that and either say that's fine, or they might say we want you to look at them all, suggest you look at them all. But I think not having a process is the bit that they would find a problem. So have you got any process for looking at processes in running? No. Right, well, that's the problem, not the detail of it. You know, the detail of it comes later, but usually they'll have a look and they'll say, have you got a process for dealing with this stuff? Yes or no. Right, well, good, I'll make some recommendations. What's your thoughts, Ollie Dilly?
Yeah, I tend to agree. The only bit really that I was going to pick up on, and we possibly touched on slightly earlier, but was the fact that there are references in a number of occasions throughout this to KPIs. And I know that that's something that we've discussed a lot in the past, how effective KPIs actually are. How do you make them more effective? How do you use them to the best of your abilities? So that was something I was going to raise, because I was asked about it recently. I was asked to set some KPIs, and Dave and I had quite a long conversation about what you actually need to look at, where it's relevant. The issue for me being that I was going into a new client, so actually determining KPIs for how they're performing is quite difficult, because I didn't know where the problem areas were necessarily at that stage. Dave, Phil, I wondered if you had any more thoughts on KPIs generally as part of this.
Yeah, I would agree, because I sometimes see a lot of the KPIs are just if nothing more than just registering the number of kind of the volume of either subject access requests or DPIAs completed or breaches that occurred. And another number you might say, well, it's interesting, we've only had three breaches this month, for example. Does that, or three near misses, does that mean we're recognising breaches? Does that mean we're not? And that kind of stuff. And you can kind of pad bits around it. Of a volume number of its own doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't say, for example, with SARS, if you had three SARS in a month, it doesn't tell you if they were completed within statutory timescales, whether you've had to extend them, whether they're particularly onerous, in that kind of stuff. It doesn't tell you whether the SAR process itself is working. It just tells you that you've had three. And that's sometimes my issues that I have with a lot of KPIs, is it's just a number. I'm kind of going, but what does that tell me about your framework? What does it tell me about your processes in place? And is it adequate? Is it working? And are there KPIs reporting issues that I can then address in that sense? But just the sheer volume, number recognition for SARs, breaches, DPIAs, that kind of thing, I don't necessarily find that helpful. And that's kind of where we
near this stuff. Go on, Dave.
Yeah, and that's where the conversation that Ollie and I had. So, for example, just looking at this first one, we've got the volume of requests fine and the percentage completed within a statutory timescales. So then that would highlight if you're potentially outside of the timescales. It would then highlight potentially whether you've exercised the extension, if it's particularly
resources.
You can remember if you have come around this evening, but if you have come, you can come tomorrow evening.
Carry on, Dave.
so it's trying to get the detail to understand. So, for example, with the SARs here, does that indicate that the SAR process is working in that sense? Or would you want KPIs? For example, if you monitored all the SARs that you've received and you put a time figure spent on them, so you've got an average time length per SAR, so then you could say, well, how many SARs are being dealt with within the kind of the average time scale? Have we got anything particularly onerous that's coming because it's suddenly taken twice as long? And does that indicate other issues? So I sometimes think we need to think a little bit deeper about, well, what are we trying to demonstrate when we're setting KPIs?
Yes, I agree with you. You know, it's they're useful to identify trends, but you know, they have to be well thought through, don't they? So, you know, they're measuring something. Is there a lack of resources? You know, what is it that the SAR? Because I think reporting the number of SARs is fine. What about other requests, I would say? But reporting the number of SARs is fine. You know, but over time, if you've got more or less SARs, is that an indication of the types of customers you're dealing with, the access of your privacy information? You know, what is it that change in the number of SARs received is indicating? Maybe people are getting more aware of their rights. Don't know, but
or maybe your customer service team is less aware of when they've received one and therefore is not pursuing them.
Yeah, maybe so. But this last one was interesting. This is a records management one. You know, again in this framework, metrics such as file retrieval statistics. You know, how many files are being retrieved this month. Interesting adherence to disposal schedules. I'm not sure what this is, the performance of the system in place to index and track paper files. But I think earlier on in the framework, they say that you should have a way of logging paper files being taken out of storage and put back into storage. So I guess it's kind of summarizing those statistics. Yeah, well, was there anything else in here that you had a quick skim through it, didn't you, beforehand? Anything else in the accountability framework that is worth picking up on, Dave?
I think one thing about the accountability framework, without picking on anything particular, is do you think it makes accountability and governance of data protection more onerous or less onerous? And for me, I think possibly it may have come through the conversations that we had. If you're a small operator, you may find the accountability framework has made it more onerous, because you've not got the skills or the finances or the size of the team to actually implement and do any of this. Whereas if you're a larger organisation that's got the governance framework in place, this would just be kind of a belts and braces approach to what you're already doing. So I think for some, it certainly has made it more onerous, but I think it's a smaller organisation.
Can I also add,
it should be
bake
this stuff in, but yeah, carry on.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say that it is just a framework. It's just some guidance. And I do know that there might be some controls already implemented by some of our clients on here. I would just say take it with a pinch of salt what's in those trackers, because you don't want to introduce those controls or the expectations that the ICO want if it's going to result in further risk or introducing new or different problems elsewhere. So, for example, if you've got a very good breach procedure, if you've got a good reporting line, if you've got good KPIs around them, but on the tracker, accountability tracker, it's introducing more additional things that you feel, I would just say that if you feel it's sufficient, it's appropriate, it helps you meet the requirements of the law, stick to it. Just take it as a pinch of salt, the framework. That's what I say. Let it not introduce further risks.
Yeah, Ollie, have you what did you, anything in particular you wanted to pull out of the accountability discussion or framework?
No, there was nothing more that I was going to add. There is a question in the chat that I was going to come back on at some point, just in relation to the regulator of social housing white paper, but we can touch on that at the end if anyone's got any more points on accountability to raise first.
I'm not actually checked. Have we got any? I'm looking at the chat. Have we got any questions in the chat?
No, that's the only one. And then comments about the crackling, unfortunately, Phil.
Right, I think it's probably my microphone here. I was going to talk about, the frozen GDPR this week. We probably haven't got enough time left. I'll see if we can pick it up next week. That's, again, a weird concept to have a look at. So is there any final thoughts, Dave, Dilly, Collie, before we wrap up?
No, sorry from my end. Sorry, Phil. I'm one to guess.
Yeah, for me, I think it just, whether you're following the framework exactly or whether you're kind of looking to it for guidance, I think the main thing for me is just being able to demonstrate through evidence how you meet the law and why you're making decisions. So you've always got that, you've always got some evidence to tie back to why you've taken a particular approach, or why you've assessed something in a particular way, or taken a set a particular procedure in a way. So I'd always tie it back to accountability, because accountability itself runs right through the GDPR. With if you just look at, for example, now the UK GDPR, you just look, for example, at how many times it mentions technical and organisational measures. I think it comes up something like, 39 times within the GDPR, within the articles, where you've got to evidence technical and organisational measures. So that's an account form of accountability as well. So I think just being able to look at accountability is, can you demonstrate why we've taken a particular approach through evidence? And I think that would certainly be one of the takeaways for myself.
Ollie, anything from you? I think I asked out Miles what we're going to talk about next week. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head. Anything, Ollie, from you, final points?
Final points. I mean, fundamentally, one of my biggest bugbears, and I'm sure it's the same for a lot of people in the industry, is reviewing a decision that's been made and asking for the reasoning behind it, and it's not been documented. And this all ties in the number of times you see instances where, whether it's a breach that's not been reported, whether it's a DPIA that's not been deemed necessary, X, Y, Z, not having sufficient process in place to actually document that decision-making, the rationale behind it, it's a real issue. So having those processes in place is critical, fundamentally. That's my sort of take on it all.
I would agree. That's kind of in part how I see it as well, Ollie, with the just being able to demonstrate your thinking and document that evidentially. And so I agree with what you said there, Ollie.
Yeah, absolutely. So just before we wrap up, because I think that's about it on accountability, there was a question in the chat about something which I mentioned much earlier, and I just sort of wanted to make sure that we address that. So to the attention of our clients in the social housing sector, what I was referring to earlier is the white paper produced by the regulator of social housing, which will look to introduce a series of new standards and obligations for social housing landlords. But one of the ones that they're introducing in particular is a new scheme for tenants to have access to information relating to their housing and their housing providers. It's all we know at this stage. What they've said is that it's essentially going to mirror in some aspects the Freedom of Information Act, but it's not going to make housing providers subject directly to the Freedom of Information Act. Now, as I say, we basically haven't got any more information than that. It's two lines in a white paper. I'll link it in the chat for everyone if you're interested. But just to clarify, that's what I was referring to earlier.
Thank you for that, Ollie.
We've got a compliance audits next week, so we've got how to get the most out of your compliance. So that's a session that's booked.
All right, well, that should be good fun. I mean, I want to go through the because there's a really good piece of work that the ICO produced years ago, like 15 years ago, the auditor's handbook, which is brilliant, you know, full of checklists, full of useful stuff. It's all oriented towards the old Data Protection Act, but again, if you're trying to build a audit program, then it's a really good resource. I've sent it to you, haven't I, Dilik?
Yes, you have.
Yeah.
It's a PDF form, isn't it, that one?
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's a good start, isn't it? Right, well, I think that's probably, unless everybody wants any further questions or points to make, I think we've probably run out of time. So apologies for the crack. I'm going to buy a new pair of headphones on eBay now, and then hopefully it'll come before next week. So apologies if that was irritating to listen to. Even more irritating than normal to listen to, should I say. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you, Dave, Ollie and Dilik for contributions. Thanks, Miles, for organising it. Next week, we're going to be talking about audits. We sent out, I believe, a new programme to take us through March and April to talk about some topical issues, which should be good fun. Have a great weekend, and hopefully we'll catch up with you next week.
Thanks, guys.